rushing back into the chapel and up to Hugo.
I have to go with him. There is food in the basket, and you may be in great danger. The partisans...
I heard, he said. They may plan to meet here.
I will keep my ears open, she said, and try to come and warn you. But you also must be on the lookout and ready to hide if necessary. If you could get that door open, maybe you would have an escape route.
I've tried, he said. It won't move.
Then maybe you should no longer stay down here. You would be trapped. At least you were hidden in your little spot under the altar.
Yes, he agreed. You'd better go, or that child will come back looking for you.
Take care, Ugo.
She reached up and kissed his cheek. Then she ran out.
Sorry, Gianni,
he heard her calling.
I could not find my basket in the darkness. It is nothing but rubble in there now, and unstable. I shall have to come back for it in the morning.
Darkness had fallen. Hugo got out his lighter and made his way down the stairs to light his candle. He felt horribly vulnerable, trapped. If he stayed down here, he would not be able to run if he was found. He lit his candle and carried his belongings upstairs and back to his former hiding place. It was cold and damp and uninviting, but he set up his bed and then dragged over more splintered pieces of wood to conceal himself. In the daylight, he'd have to do a better job, and maybe close up the crypt again. The thought of the partisans finding the painting, and maybe even taking it to sell or barter, made him want to go down and take it off the wall immediately. But his candle was burning low. Who knew how much fluid remained in his lighter? He couldn't chance finding himself down there in complete darkness, possibly becoming trapped. He retrieved the basket and ate the soup that Sophia had brought for him. Another bleak thought struck him. If the partisans were really going to use this as a meeting place, then Sophia could not risk coming here again. He would have to come to a decision and take action soon. He could now put some weight on his injured leg. Maybe it was time to go and trust his luck. He settled himself in the narrow space and spent a miserable night, alert for the smallest sound. At some time during the long hours of darkness, he thought he heard gunshots, or it could have been thunder. The night dragged on for an eternity, and he was relieved to see the first streaks of cold daylight. They wouldn't come during daylight, he was sure. This sight was too open and exposed. That gave him time to think and plan. He went down the steps and stood in front of the painting of the child Jesus. Even in the semi-darkness, it seemed to glow with an inner light. It still took his breath away. I must find a safe hiding place for it, he thought. He moved around the small crypt. There was space behind some of the tombs, but any thorough search would uncover the painting quickly. There was also a gap behind the altar. A possibility, he thought. He was still down there when he heard footsteps up above. He swore under his breath, realizing he had left his revolver and knife tucked with his belongings. Looking around, he could come up with nowhere to hide other than behind the carved stonework screen. Hardly a secure hiding place. Caught like a rat in a trap, he muttered. He heard the feet come to the top of the steps and saw a shadow blocking the daylight. A voice called softly.
Ugo? Are you down there?
Sophia. He let out a huge sigh of relief and hurried to meet her. I didn't expect you again so soon, and in daylight. You mustn't take such risks, please.
Bad news, she said,
gasping as if she had run all the way.
Terrible news, Ugo. Gianni was right that our local partisans were planning a raid. But someone must have tipped off the Germans. They were waiting for them, and all were slaughtered except for Cosimo.
How come he managed to get away? Hugo, who had taken a dislike to Cosimo without ever meeting him, was instantly suspicious.
It was a miracle. The first bullet just grazed his shoulder. He flung himself to the ground, and the body of one of his comrades fell on top of him. He said he lay there while the soldiers went around driving their bayonets into the bodies to make sure they were really dead. He didn't dare move for hours. When daylight came, he crawled out and made his way home. I've never seen a man look more exhausted and distraught.
So someone tipped off the Germans. That means you have a spy in your midst.
Maybe not in San Salvatore. These men come from other villages, too. Some are not even originally from around here. They are soldiers who fled from their regiments, rather than be taken prisoners of war by the Germans. One of them could have been planted as a spy.
All too easily, he agreed. But at least this is good news for me. For us, isn't it? They will not be using this as a meeting place. She shook her head. She was crying now.
But it is worse than you think. German trucks came into the village first thing this morning. They questioned everybody about the partisans, and they said they were going over the bodies, and if they identified one of them as coming from this village, then we would all be shot.
And Cosimo? Did they find him?
No. He escaped out into the fields when someone saw the trucks coming. He will have to stay hidden, I think.
Oh, this is terrible, Hugo said. She nodded.
It is more than terrible. The major in charge also asked us about an English airman. They said your plane had just been discovered, and there were only two bodies in it, and nobody in the pilot's seat. They asked if anybody had seen or heard any rumor of an Englishman hiding out. Nobody had seen anything, nobody said anything. Then this German said, if it was found that any of us had helped an enemy, the whole village would suffer. You should have seen his face. He was actually looking forward to massacring all of us, I am sure.
She stared at him, her eyes bleak and hopeless. Then I must get away now, Hugo said. And you must come with me, Sophia. He took her hand. She turned away.
I can't leave my son, or my husband's grandmother.
Bring Renzo with you. You want to save your son, don't you? The neighbors will take care of the old lady, and it won't be for long. We'll go south. We'll find a way.
But how can you walk? Your leg still is not strong enough.
This was all too true. Where is the nearest transportation? Are there no buses, trains?
There's the train line down in the Serchio Valley, about 10 miles from here. The train goes to Lucca. I do not know if that is still in territory controlled by the Germans, and I do not even know if trains are still running. And to travel you must show documents. They would find you.
Then we must try to steal a German car or truck.
And how is that less dangerous than staying where I am and praying that nobody has seen me?
Her voice was shrill now.
And if they decide to shoot the whole village?
His voice had risen too, echoing back from the walls.
I want to save you, Sophia. I want to protect you. I'll give myself up to them. I'll say I was hiding out in the countryside and nobody aided me. No.
She grasped at his arm.
No. I can't let you do that. I won't let you do it.
But I would be a prisoner of war, and I'm an officer. Officially, they have to treat me properly and take me to an officer's prison camp. She shook her head violently so that her shawl fell to her shoulders.
They would kill you right away. I know it. They are retreating and scared. They will not want to take prisoners along. I don't want to lose you, Ugo. I don't want to lose you either.
He wrapped his arms around her. She buried her head in his jacket as she had done when the bomb had fallen. They stood there together in silence. He stroked her hair gently as if she was a child.
There must be a way,
he said angrily. She looked up at him. Is there no one around here who has a car or truck? He asked. She shrugged.
All taken from us. Besides, there is no petrol. Some farmers still have a horse or donkey. I know of a farmer who has a cart to take his produce to the market in Ponte a Mariano. I have heard that he has taken black market items before now, but he charges much money and I have none, and nothing to sell.
Hugo frowned, thinking desperately. Then he pulled his signet ring off his little finger. Take this. It's gold. He put it into her hand and closed her fingers around it. I don't know if it will be enough, but tell him we just want to borrow the cart. We will leave it where it can be found and he can collect it. She nodded solemnly.
I don't exactly know where he lives, but someone in the village will. It is too bad that Cosimo has to hide out, because he would know. He knows of black market dealings, I'm sure.
We don't want Cosimo to know anything, Hugo said sharply. We don't want anyone to know. We can't risk them going to the Germans.
Perhaps you are right,
she agreed.
Very well. I will try. I will do my best. But it will not be easy. I do not think the Germans will leave us alone now. And if they identify one of those men as coming from our village, then it will all be over. We will be slaughtered like animals.
Surely they wouldn't go through with that, he said. Not women and children.
Oh, yes. They have done this in other towns. All the population slaughtered because these people have aided the enemy. I'm sure they would do it.
Then for God's sake, go and find this man today. I will make myself ready to leave, and I will keep watch. I can see the road from here. If German vehicles are coming, I'll go down into the forest to wait for you. She nodded, clearly trying to come to terms with the burden of so much worry at once. Hugo grabbed her arm. And Sophia, if it's not safe, don't come again. Save yourself. Save Renzo. That's all that matters. I love you. I know I shouldn't, because you are a married woman and I am a married man, but I do. I'd do anything in the world to protect you.
I love you too, Hugo,
she said in a small voice. He took her face in his hands and kissed her tenderly on the lips. He felt desire stirring in him, but broke away hastily. Go now, while there's still time. Tears were running down her cheeks.
God protect you, Hugo,
she said. And you, he called after her, as she ran out into the night. Chapter 34 Hugo, December 1944. After she had gone, he remained rooted in place, trying to think clearly. He was a British officer, combat-trained. He should be able to come up with a good plan. He had 6 bullets in the chambers of his revolver. At least he could kill the first 6 Germans if he took them by surprise. But then they would take reprisals against the village. Sophia had to find the man with the cart and make him lend it to her. The ring was a good one. Heavy, 22-carat gold, worth a lot. A simple farmer would be tempted, surely. Then his eyes strayed to the painting of the child Jesus. He had to protect that, too. No German was going to loot it. He lifted it down from the wall with difficulty, surprised at how heavy it was. He wondered if the frame was actually made of gold and not gold leaf. Held close in front of him, the child seemed almost to be exchanging a secret joke with him. He had an overwhelming desire to take the canvas from its frame, roll it up, and stuff it into his jacket or parachute pouch. But his artist's training would not let him do such a thing. The old paint would crack, and the painting would be ruined. And it was certainly too large and heavy to carry with him. It had to be hidden until the Germans had finally retreated northward. He went back to the little door in the wall. It was made of solid oak, with carved panels and a keyhole big enough for an ancient key. He fetched his knife and tried prying the lock, then cutting out a section of the door, but the attempts were futile. The wood was too thick, and the door was snugly built into the stone. He was loath to carry the painting upstairs, where it would be exposed to the wind and weather. In the end, he tucked it behind the altar. At least nobody would find it unless they searched well. Then he went back upstairs to keep a lookout. It was a blustery day, with clouds racing in from the west and the promise of more rain. Hugo scanned the countryside in all directions, but nothing moved on the road, and the surrounding fields were empty and bare. Desolate landscape, he thought. It echoed his mood. He looked over the recent landslide down to the track. Could I make it down to the road, if Sophia has to bring the cart that way? He wondered. A little voice in his head whispered that he should just run for it now and not put Sophia at any more risk. He returned to the rubble beside the chapel to see if he could salvage anything of use. Something that could be used as a weapon, maybe. But the walls had already collapsed in the first bombardment. Nothing much had shifted when the latest bomb fell. In truth, there was nothing left to destroy. Bending with difficulty, he idly turned over smaller pieces of masonry, not knowing what he hoped to find. Then he found himself looking at a large iron ring poking from beneath the stones. Intrigued, he lifted more masonry away and pulled out a key ring with several large keys attached. He held it in his hand, staring for a long moment while his heart beat faster. Surely he couldn't be lucky enough to have found the key to the door. He made his way back inside, moving as fast as he could, not even noticing the pain in his wounded leg. He was brought back to sanity when he almost tripped going down the steps into the crypt. He had to steady himself against the wall, and so took the last steps at a more careful pace. One by one, he tried the keys in the lock, and at last the biggest one fitted. He turned it and heard the lock click. He pushed, but the door didn't budge. It must have jammed when the building shifted during its collapse. He threw his shoulder against it and felt it move, but still it wouldn't open. Gritting his teeth with frustration, he tried again. At last it opened, scraping against the stone floor with a loud screech that echoed alarmingly through the crypt. Hastily he reached for his lighter and poked his head around the door. Then he snapped the lighter shut and sighed. There had once been a passage, but it was blocked with rubble, only a couple of feet beyond the door. Barely enough room for a slim person like him to squeeze around it. A door into nowhere. Hugo swallowed back his disappointment, but then an idea came to him. A door into nowhere. He squeezed around the half-open door and checked the rubble beyond. The passage was well and truly blocked. He examined the back of the door, then nodded. It could work. The best solution for now. He extricated himself again and went back upstairs, although his leg was already giving him signals that he had done enough and needed to rest. There was certainly plenty of lumber to choose from. Shattered pews and kneelers, smashed altar tables, and carved pieces that must have been parts of the high altar once. He chose four relatively straight and sturdy lengths, and then worked to prise out the nails from the shattered wood. It was long and tedious work. Then he carried his materials downstairs with a good round piece of marble that had probably been part of a saint's statue. He squeezed around the door, noting dryly how good it was that he had eaten so little for a month now and was horribly thin. Then he set to work building a crude frame, into which the painting could fit on the back of the door. He had never been much of a carpenter. He had never needed to be, with plenty of servants to do the manual work. And there was much swearing as he tried to hammer rusty nails through varnished wood and into a solid door. But, in the end, he achieved what he had envisioned. He lifted up the painting and pushed it into the enclosing wood frame. "Va bene," he said out loud in Italian. He now hammered short pieces diagonally across the corners to hold the painting in place. Even if anyone managed to force the door open, they would only see a blocked passage. The painting would be safe until Sophia could return, and the Germans had retreated. Hugo felt very satisfied with himself as he came wearily up the steps. If only he could protect the rest of the artworks in the little crypt. He imagined Germans hauling off the other big paintings with delight, taking down the crucifix, even knocking down the saints and the marble figures on the tombs. Then another idea came to him. The former door to the chapel that had fallen when the last bomb hit, it might just fit over the opening that led down to the crypt. He picked his way across unstable rubble to where it lay, and then attempted to drag it along the floor. It was large and incredibly heavy. His leg sent out waves of pain every time he bent and then pulled at the door. His forehead was soon coated in beads of sweat, and he felt nauseous. He had to admit defeat, and realized he needed to wait for Sophia. But he had no idea when she could come, or how quickly he'd have to leave once she got there. He went to lie down, the revolver and knife at the ready by his right hand. The rest of the day passed, and Sophia didn't come. He agonized over what that might mean. She had not found the farmer with the cart, or the Germans were still in the area and were watching her. It could be something as simple as her son being afraid and not wanting to leave her side. This reassured him a little. He would just have to be patient and pray that the Germans had not identified any of the bodies of those dead partisans as coming from San Salvatore. Night fell. Hugo was now desperately hungry. He stuffed the remaining parachute into its pouch. Silk might be a good thing to barter, given Sophia's enthusiasm for it. In the morning, he would scatter the items he had acquired over the ruins, so that all traces of his occupation there were removed. He dozed, then jerked awake again at the smallest of sounds. But he must have finally fallen asleep, because Sophia was suddenly beside him. He felt her soft hair touch his cheek. He opened his eyes, not knowing if this was reality or just one of his dreams about her.
"Ugo, mio caro,"
she whispered, her face only inches from his. Instinctively, he took her into his arms and felt her body warm against his. Then he was kissing her hungrily. The pent-up desire mingled with his fear, and she was responding, her slender body pressing against him. His hand fumbled with her skirts, felt the flesh of her upper thigh, tugged at her underpants. And he realized she was unbuttoning his trousers. Then he rolled onto her, the pain in his leg forgotten, the Germans forgotten, the war forgotten. Afterward, they lay together in silence, their breathing in harmony.
"Ugo, I must move,
she said at last.
The rocks dig into my back.
The next time we do that, it will be in a big, beautiful bed with a feather mattress, he whispered in her ear as he helped her to sit up. Much more comfortable.
You can believe there will be a next time?
She asked. I can. We will get away, Sophia. You and I. And if your Guido is truly dead. She put her fingers to his lips.
Not go on. Who can think about the future?
What about the cart? Did you find the farmer?
Not yet. I could not leave the village. It is so bad, Ugo. The Germans are not going to leave us. One of them has come to stay at my house. He has taken the best bedroom upstairs.
In your house? Oh, that's terrible, Sophia. For God's sake, take Renzo, go find the cart, and we'll leave immediately.
I wanted to go yesterday, but this German asked me where I was going. I told him my turnips were almost ready for harvest. I was going to check on my field, and if they were ready, I had to arrange for a cart to take them to market.
Well, that was clever. She shook her head.
He said he would send one of his men with me to help me dig up the turnips.
She paused and sighed.
I told him that was not necessary. I was strong. I was used to hard work. But he said he wanted to help, in return for giving him accommodation.
Well, so he sounds like a decent sort of man, then. She turned away.
Who knows? It may be that they have been instructed not to let any of us out of their sight. And I don't like the way he looked at me. He watched me, going upstairs. I could feel his eyes on me.
You took an awful risk coming here now, he said. What if he checks on you at night?
I locked my bedroom door, she said. I have brought Renzo to sleep with me. I just pray that he doesn't wake before I get back.
Hugo felt impotent rage building inside him. Well, then you should return immediately.
I'm afraid I could only bring you a little polenta and a few cold beans, she said. The German ate two helpings of the stew I had made. I told him we had almost no food, and he said not to worry, he would bring me more. He said his men were good to those who cooperated. I told him I had no choice. I had to protect my son and the old woman. And then he smiled and said, "You have no reason to fear me." I wish I could believe him.
Will he be in your house all day, do you think?
He knows I must go to my field. If he sends a man with me, I will tell that man to keep digging while I go and arrange for the cart to market. And even if he insists on accompanying me to the old farmer, he will not speak our language, and he will certainly not speak my Tuscan dialect. I can arrange for the cart in front of him.
Hugo put his arm around her. You're very brave, Sophia.
I feel so helpless and useless stuck here.
I should be protecting you. Instead, you are risking everything for me.
And for me, too, now. I realize I must get my son to safety. And myself.
She stood up, adjusting her skirts and wrapping her shawl around her.
Let us hope I can take the cart tomorrow. Then I can load it with turnips, and you can hide among them, and we will be free.
You make it sound so easy.
We must trust in God. That is all we can do, she said.
Hugo pulled himself to his feet beside her. Before you go, I need you to help me with one thing. That old door. We can cover the opening to the crypt and disguise it.
And the painting?
I've hidden it, Sophia. A perfect hiding place. Behind the secret door.
The door in the wall?
Yes, I have the key. I will take it with us and give it to you when it is safe for you to return.
You are so clever, Ugo. Our beautiful boy will be safe and dry down there.
Yes, he agreed. He went over to the great door. She bent beside him, and together they manhandled it across the rubble until it was in place over the opening. It fitted perfectly. They looked up at each other and exchanged a grin of conspirators. You go, he said. I will cover it with rocks and wood, and nobody will ever know it was there.
Yes,
she said. She came to him and kissed him full and hard on the lips.
Until tomorrow, amore mio.
Chapter 35. Joanna. June 1973.
Oh, there you are, Paola said, looking up from the beans she had been retying. I was beginning to get worried about you. I thought you had gone up to the town, but then Renzo came seeking you, and said that you were not up there. Renzo came. I blurted out the words. Yes, looking for you. She misinterpreted my alarm. I think you might have made a conquest there, Mia Cara. She gave me a knowing little smile. Did he say what he wanted? He didn't. Maybe just to enjoy your company, to get to know you better. Oh, no, it's not like that, I said. He must have wanted to arrange a time to meet me and take me to the station tomorrow. Tomorrow? So you will really leave so soon? I think it would be wise, I said. If I stay longer, then I fear that the inspector may still try to say that I killed Gianni. He may also try to say that you helped me. It is better for everyone that I go when I can. And Cosimo told me that his son has to drive into Florence tomorrow and will give me a ride to the train station. So soon. She came around the table and embraced me. I will miss you, little one. You have become a second daughter, and Angelina has enjoyed your company too. She says I am old and boring, and it is good to speak to someone her age. I know. I have enjoyed every minute with you, especially your cooking, and I am sorry that I will now never learn to become an Italian cook. We will have a good meal tonight, if it is to be your last, she said. A mushroom risotto, perhaps, before the aubergine parmesan and panna cotta, definitely. You can help me to prepare them if you like. We will start with crostini. Perhaps Signor Renzo will want to help us too.
Renzo? I asked.
Yes, I invited him to join us for dinner, and I know that he loves to cook.
I could tell from her face what she was thinking. She was playing matchmaker with Renzo and me. On any other occasion, I might have welcomed her help. But now I knew what I did, I didn't want any more to do with him. The chats we had, his taking me to his old house, they were probably designed to find out what I knew and what I didn't know. He was just following instructions from Cosimo. I took this one stage further. Had he also witnessed Gianni pushing the envelope into my room, and now wanted to retrieve its contents or find out what it said? I couldn't stop him from coming, but I would have to tread very carefully this evening. I put my purse back in my room, locked the door again, and came to help Paola in the garden. Later, I had a rest, locking myself in, but I slept undisturbed and awoke feeling refreshed. Heading over to the farmhouse to see if the preparations had begun for dinner, I was startled to find Renzo standing close to my door. Oh, I gasped, and took an involuntary step back.
Sorry if I startled you, Joanna, he said. Paola wanted me to pick more asparagus and see if any more tomatoes were ripe. I came early to help prepare the meal. She is making a real feast for you.
I know, she told me. She is so kind.
She has become fond of you, he said. She is sorry you have to leave so soon.
I am too, but it's better that way, isn't it? I said. I would rather be far away from that inspector. He still seems to think I might be somehow involved with Gianni's murder, which is ridiculous. I only exchanged maybe a dozen words with the man at a table full of other men.
Quite ridiculous, he said. But I too am sorry you are going to leave. I would like to have found out the truth about your father and my mother, and the beautiful boy. I can't stop thinking about it. If your father was in this area long enough for my mother to have a child, how could they possibly have kept both those things secret? And would he have hidden a child where nobody else could find him, only to write to her about him months later?
Perhaps the child was given to a family in the hills to look after, I suggested. She was going to reclaim him later, but she never did.
Then why does nobody know about this? Surely the family would have told someone. They would have said, a British airman left a baby with us. Now we have to find his mother. There would have been talk. Old memories would have been jogged.
Yes, I said. And yet nobody in San Salvatore seems to know anything about a British airman. And everyone believes that your mother ran off with a German.
It's strange, he said,
straightening up from where he had just picked a big ripe tomato.
But old memories are beginning to come back to me. I remember I was sick for a while. I'm not sure what it was. Measles? Something like that. Anyway, I couldn't leave the house, and my mother went out every day looking for things for us to eat. Mushrooms, chestnuts. Once there was a pigeon, I remember that. I wanted to go with her, but she said that I had to stay indoors because of my chest. I watched her going up the hill with her basket. She was worried about me, and hated to leave me. But we had to eat, didn't we?
She was worried about you. I stared at him. Renzo, everything you say tells me that your mother loved you dearly. She would not have abandoned you, I'm sure. She would not have run off and just left you behind. I'm sure she must have been forced to leave against her will.
But everyone said... He began hesitantly. I've always been told.
You know what I think? I said. I think someone betrayed your mother and my father, maybe for money, or maybe out of jealousy, or maybe to save their own skin. And the Germans took her away. I realized as I said it that I might just be causing him more grief. What if the person who betrayed her was Cosimo? Then I remembered that Gianni had seen the British airman being driven off, and he was an opportunist and a sneak. Perhaps he had tipped off the Germans that a British airman had been hiding out. Did you see her go? Or had she just gone by the time you woke up in the morning? He frowned, trying to recollect.
No, I was there, I'm pretty sure. Yes, she came over and kissed me, and told me to be a good boy and that she'd be back soon. She was crying. There were teardrops on her cheeks. And then she wanted to sing more and kiss me again, but the soldiers shouted at her and...
He broke off, a look of wonder on his face.
It wasn't the soldier who was staying at our house, the nice one. It was another soldier, a big man. I remember that he seemed to feel the whole doorway, and he yelled in a fierce voice.
You see? I smiled at him triumphantly. Your mother and my father were innocent. They loved each other, and they were betrayed.
Yes, he said softly. I have to believe you. Are we ever going to get those tomatoes for tonight's meal?
Came Paola's big voice across the rows of vegetables. Renzo grinned to me.
The slave driver calls. Come and help prepare the meal.
I followed him along the narrow path, now more confused than ever. Had Cosimo betrayed Renzo's mother, and then felt guilty enough that he had adopted him? Perhaps Renzo knew no more than I did. Renzo fell back to wait for me.
I've been thinking, he said. My mother always went up the hill with her basket. It is possible that your father was hidden somewhere in the woods, or even in the old monastery. We should go and look tomorrow before you leave us.
I was wondering about the old monastery myself, I said, but it just looks like piles of ruined stone. Could someone really have sought shelter up there?
I went up a couple of times when I was a boy, Renzo said. It's all fenced off, and nobody is supposed to go there because the hillside is in danger of collapsing. But of course, when we were boys, we had to do it on a dare. There truly wasn't much to see. The walls of the old chapel still stood, but there was no roof, and the floor was piled high with rubble. The rooms of the monastery were completely flattened. If your father hid out up there, then he would have had a miserable time.
He'd been to a British boarding school, I said. He was probably used to a miserable time. This made Renzo throw back his head and laugh.
You English in your boarding schools, he said. Was your school also like that?
I didn't board at the school I told you about, but it was certainly not a good experience for me. I couldn't wait to leave.
So you too have had your share of miserable times.
Yes, you could say that. He put a hand on my shoulder.
Perhaps it is time to put the past behind you and to look forward to the future. You will be a rich and famous lawyer. You will travel and marry an equally rich man, and have the perfect two children, and live happily in one of those big, drafty English houses.
I looked up at him, horribly conscious of his hand, warm and comforting on my shoulder. I'm not sure that's what I want at all, I said.
So what do you want?
I'm not sure. I'll know when I find it. Renzo released me and stood aside for me to enter the house first.
Allora, now we get to work, Paola said. With so many courses to prepare, I need much assistance. First, we make the toppings for the crostini.
What's a crostini? I asked.
Like bruschetta, but instead of being baked, the slices of bread are grilled,
Renzo said.
More chewy and less brittle.
He turned to Paola.
And what toppings have you in mind?
The fresh asparagus, naturally.
Wrapped in prosciutto crudo, naturally, he said. And fennel? I see you have fennel growing in your garden. Should I dig up a bulb and slice it thinly with some pecorino?
That would be a wonderful idea, she said. And I have a good tapenade here.
And will you allow me to make the risotto?
He asked.
It was one of my specialties when I was a sous chef at a restaurant in Soho.
With pleasure, Paola said.
But you must show the young lady how you prepare it. She wants to learn how to cook our Italian food, you know.
He looked at me with interest.
You want to learn to cook? Lawyers don't need such skills. They can employ a cook, surely.
Not this lawyer, I said. At the moment, I am still a poor articled clerk, earning almost no money until I pass my exam, and even if I get a good job, I think that coming home to cook a good meal would be very relaxing.
You are right, he said. When I am cooking, I think of nothing else. It is as if all the troubles of the world are shut out, and it is just me and the food.
Paola frowned, and Renzo translated for her.
You should speak Italian to the young lady, she said. How else is she going to improve? And already she understands quite well.
All right. In future, only Italian, Giovanna. Capisci?
He said, giving me a challenging look. I was given the herbs to chop up for the sauce to go on the aubergine. Oregano, Italian parsley, and then lots of garlic to crush. I was concentrating hard when Renzo came up behind me.
No, that is not how you hold the knife, he said.
His fingers came over mine.
Straight, up and down, swift motion like this, see?
Renzo, you will distract the young lady from her task if you flirt with her like that, Paola said.
What does this word mean? I asked. When Renzo translated, I felt myself blushing.
Flirting? Who was flirting? He demanded. I only wish to correct the way she cuts parsley. If she wants to cook well, she must develop good skills.
You say what you like, Paola said, chuckling. I say what I observe. See, her cheeks have become quite pink.
But she did not push me away, so she must have liked it, he replied. Now let me see you cut, Joe.
I realized he was using the abbreviation of my name that only a few people had used in my life. Scarlet was one, and Adrian was another. But coming from Renzo, it sounded right. I started cutting, making smooth and even chopping motions. He watched, nodding.
You learn quickly.
It is a shame she is not going to stay longer. You and I could teach her much, Paola said. Instead, she goes back to London and to her diet of roast beef and sausages.
Yes, it is a shame, Renzo said.
I had to agree with them. I went back to chopping my herbs. Chapter 36. Joanna. June 1973. By 8 o'clock, the meal was ready.
I think outside, don't you? Paola said, since it is such a beautiful evening.
So a table was laid with a white cloth out in the garden under the cherry tree. This time there were no simple ceramic beakers, but silverware and crystal. I took my place looking out away from the farmhouse. The sun was setting over the western hills, and bats flitted through the pink twilight. The air was scented with honeysuckle and jasmine. It was almost like being in a dream. Angelina came to join us, bringing olive oil and a plate of olives. It turned out that Renzo had brought wine from his father's vineyards. We started with a crisp white as Paola brought out the tray of crostini. I had to try one of each topping as I had done my first night in San Salvatore in the piazza. The asparagus wrapped in slivers of uncured ham and drizzled with truffle oil. The thin slices of fennel, which was another new flavour for me. The sharp sheep's cheese served with fig jam. All of these tasted like little miracles, and frankly would have been enough for a grand evening meal on their own. But then we had Renzo's risotto, creamy rice with mushrooms cooked in a rich broth. When Renzo saw my nod of appreciation, he said,
In London, I used to make this with seafood. You should try it. The fish broth and the mussels and shrimp are just perfect. It is too bad I can't make a trip to the coast and bring back the right ingredients to cook for you.
I can't imagine it would be much better than this, I said. I grew up being forced to eat rice pudding at school, and I've shied away from rice ever since. He laughed.
The English unfortunately don't know what interesting things can be done with simple ingredients. Give them cabbage or Brussels sprouts and they boil them to death.
Maybe you can come back to England one day, Open your own restaurant and educate everyone, I said. I watched the joy drain from his face.
Maybe, he said. But I don't see that day happening. My father's health does not improve, and frankly he needs me here. Family comes first, does it not?
I thought about this. A strange notion to me. I certainly had not put my father first in any of my decisions. Maybe I had failed him. I didn't like to think about it, but I pictured his body lying cold in the grass. And now it was too late to say I was sorry.
But we can fix these gloomy thoughts, Renzo said, with another good wine. This is the pride of our vineyard. In England, the only Italian wine you know is the rough Chianti that comes in a straw bottle. But this is from our premium grapes, perfectly aged in oak barrels. You will taste the difference.
The white wine was already having its effect, and I hesitated as I took a sip of the red. I don't have far to walk home, I told myself. The first taste was smooth and rich, like drinking red velvet.
Oh, I said,
and Renzo smiled.
Now you will go home and be a wine snob and say to your friends, this is not like that cheap Chianti that they produce, the wine in the straw bottle, he said.
I doubt that I could afford to buy this in England, I said. Wine is very expensive.
You are right. You couldn't buy this in England, he said. We only produce a few cases of this wine, and it goes straight to our preferred customers in Rome and Milan. Film stars, racing car drivers, and millionaires.
Then I am indeed honored. My gaze met his, and I felt a shiver go down my spine. I tried to make light of it. But don't top up my glass or I may not find my way home.
Don't worry, Renzo will escort you, Paola said.
That did bring me back to reality. Renzo walking me back to the little house, past the well into which Gianni had been stuffed head first, and the high probability that Renzo knew something about this. Had he been sent to get me drunk, to gain entrance to my room and find the envelope that Gianni had pushed through my window?
What's the matter?
Renzo asked me, as if reading my thoughts. Just that I am sad I will be leaving all this beauty tomorrow.
And I am sad that you are going, he said. Perhaps you can return in less worrying times.
I doubt that, I said. The inspector might invent new charges against me if I come back. He laughed, but I sensed that I wasn't too far from the truth. I got up to help Paola clear away the dishes, but she waved for me to stay seated.
Why else do I have a daughter? She said. You are the guest. Sit. Talk with Renzo.
As they disappeared into the house, I grinned. I'm afraid Paola is trying to do some matchmaking.
She has a good heart, he replied, and her judgment is not bad either.
I chuckled nervously, because I was highly conscious of his presence across the table from me, his crisp white shirt unbuttoned at the throat, his unruly black curls, and his eyes that sparkled as if they were on fire. It must have been the wine, but I wanted him to take me in his arms and kiss me. That ridiculous thought was banished by Paola coming back with the big dish of aubergine parmesan. I didn't think I had any room for another mouthful, but once I took my first bite, I had to finish my plate. So rich, so creamy, and the aubergine tasted like a really good meat. We finished the meal with the little dishes of panna cotta, smooth and white and slipping easily down the throat, and to accompany it, a glass of limoncello, the local liqueur. A soft, velvety darkness had fallen over the land. The night air was full of the sound of crickets and frogs. Renzo stood up.
I should probably be getting home, he said. My father will wonder where I am.
He looked at me.
May I escort you to your room first?
Oh, no, I said, laughing. I must help Paola and Angelina with the washing up. We must have made a lot of dishes dirty.
Of course you do not need to do this, Paola said. Let the young man escort you if he volunteers. I know if a handsome man offered to escort me to my room, I would not say no. Unfortunately, such offers do not come anymore.
And she laughed. I had no choice. Renzo offered me his arm. I took it, giving him a nervous smile. Honestly, Renzo, I can find my way to my room unaided, I said. And I'm sure Cosimo will be pacing the floor waiting for you to come home.
Let him pace, Renzo said. Did it not occur to you that I might want to spend some time alone with you?
I looked up at him then. He was giving me a little half-smile.
I don't know what it is about you, he said. I find myself strangely drawn to you. Maybe you remind me of the girl I once knew in London, the one I might have married if things had been different.
He turned to face me.
Do I not detect that you are also a little attracted to me?
Maybe a little, I said, trying not to ignore the warning alarm going off in my head. Cosimo's son, remember?
Then perhaps it is in our shared history, Renzo said. Maybe it is the story of my mother and your father finally being completed. It is fate, destiny. There is nothing we can do about it.
Do you think so? I asked.
How do I know? He said, smiling at me. I just know that at this moment, I want to kiss you. Is that all right with you?
He didn't wait for an answer. He took me in his arms and his lips moved toward mine. I could feel my heart racing, a small frisson of danger mingling with my desire for him. I don't know where it might have led, but suddenly the ground beneath our feet was moving. It only lasted for a few seconds, but Renzo held me tight until the rocking stopped.
Was that another earthquake? I asked.
Just an aftershock, he said. Don't worry.
Isn't there a song that goes something like, I felt the earth move under my feet? I laughed, a little shakily.
Now you know it really happens, he said.
Joanna, Renzo, is all well with you? It was only a small earthquake,
Paola called from the open door.
All is well,
Renzo responded, releasing me.
I think I'd better go, he said, before the earth moves under our feet again.
He touched my cheek.
I will see you in the morning. Sleep well.
And then he went. I let myself into the little room, locked my door, undressed, and lay on my bed staring at the ceiling. Was it possible, just possible, that Renzo really did have feelings for me?
Chapter 37. Hugo. December 1944. As soon as Sophia had departed, Hugo got to work lugging pieces of masonry, as big and heavy as he could carry, to pile on top of the old door. He was still working when the sun came up. He admired his achievement. The area now matched the rest of the rubble on the floor. No one would ever suspect that an entrance to the crypt lay beneath. The beautiful boy was safe. Then he attacked the next phase, hiding any trace of his occupation of the chapel. He'd already been wearing all the extra clothes to keep out the cold, so set about dismantling his shelter, hurling the pieces of wood around the chapel. He took the blanket, sheepskin, bowl, and spoon and scattered them around the rubble, then tossed a few rocks onto them for good measure. When he was done, he looked around in satisfaction. Nobody would ever know that he had been here. All he had to do now was wait. He didn't think it likely that Sophia would be able to bring the cart to him that very day. He also didn't think she'd risk being out at night. It would be too suspicious. And how could she see to drive the wagon in the dark without lanterns? But tomorrow, at first light, that would be logical if she was going to market with a load of turnips. He ate the last crumbs of bread, drank some water, and fantasized about reaching a town to the south, an allied camp, hot food, a real bed, safety for him and for Sophia and her son. When darkness fell, he went and recovered the sheepskin to sit on, and dozed sitting up. The night seemed eternal. When the glow of dawn came in the east, he got up, then wondered if he should make his way down the steps to wait for Sophia in the forest. He decided against this, in case she came by the other side of the rock, up the track to the precipice, and he somehow had to clamber down to meet her. He wasn't sure he was up to that feat, and decided to go around and scout out the best way down just in case. As he came out of the chapel and stood blinking in the bright daylight, he saw a movement among the trees. His heart leapt and he waved. The next thing he knew, two German soldiers emerged, their guns pointed at him. One of them came nimbly up the steps.
"You are the Englishman?" he asked.
Hugo thought of lying. His Italian was now quite fluent, and he had even picked up Sophia's Tuscan dialect. but they would want to see his papers. They would search him and find his logbook and identity tags. Yes, he said. English pilot. Officer. Give me your weapon, then put up your hands. He had no alternative but to obey. He handed over the revolver. The German did not ask for his knife. You come with us now. Schnell, run. I have a broken leg, he said, lifting his trouser to reveal his splint. Leg? Kaput. Can't walk fast. There was a rapid conversation between the two men. Even with his scant knowledge of German, picked up on a couple of skiing holidays, Hugo sensed that one of them wanted to shoot him on the spot. The other disagreed, and Hugo thought he understood that their colonel would want to question him first. The German standing in front of him motioned for him to move with his weapon. Hugo went down the steps as slowly as he dared, hanging on to the railing and luring himself from step to step. He had the knife in his pocket. There was a slight chance he might be able to use it. At the foot of the steps, the two men conversed again in low voices, and he could tell they didn't agree about something. But the one who had remained at the foot of the steps prevailed.
Keep your hands on your head! March! The senior soldier barked at him.
They forced him ahead of them through the trees, one of them digging at his back with the barrel of his weapon. Hugo's leg began to hurt him, and he stumbled a couple of times.
Do not play tricks, or we will shoot you now, one of them said.
On the other side of the trees, an open military vehicle was waiting. The soldiers ordered him into the back seat.
Keep hands on your head. Do not try to escape, or Heinrich will be happy to shoot you, the one who spoke English said.
He climbed into the driver's seat, and the other soldier slid into the back beside Hugo, his weapon thrust into Hugo's side. They drove off, bouncing over the ruts between the olive trees. For the first time since the shock of being caught, Hugo's brain began to work. He scanned the fields for any sign of a cart. Had they captured Sophia and made her tell them where he was hiding? Had her son inadvertently given her away? His heart was thumping so loudly in his chest that he found it hard to breathe. If only she was safe, nothing mattered. They did not turn downward toward the road in the valley. Instead, they went up through the vineyards and joined the road he had seen on the hilltop when he first arrived, the narrow dirt road lined with cypress trees that led up to the village. Hugo prayed he was not being taken up to the village to be paraded until someone confessed to helping him, or to be forced to watch the whole village slaughtered before he met his own end. He heaved a small sigh of relief when they turned away from the village, heading north along the ridge. He scanned the countryside to both sides. No sign of a cart and horse. No sign of anybody moving in the fields. If he encountered a sympathetic officer, a soldier of the old school, he had a chance of being treated as a fellow officer and prisoner of war. Just the slightest chance of remaining alive. He tried to think of Langley Hall, his father, his wife and child. Instead, all he saw was Sophia's face, so lovely, so gentle, and his heart ached at the thought he'd never see her again. After a few miles, they joined a wider road, this one paved and no longer tree-lined. The wind sweeping down from the north was brutal. Hugo could see a town silhouetted on the hilltop ahead. Several German military vehicles were drawn up beside the road. Hugo's car stopped, and there was a brief exchange. As they spoke, Hugo noticed the men glancing up nervously. He could not turn round, but he could hear the reason for their concern. The deep thrum of approaching aircraft. Soon the low drone became a roar. The German soldiers who had been standing around rushed for their vehicles or fled into the fields to hide among the vineyards. The first wave passed overhead, their shadows making black crosses on the fields, big American bombers. There was a whistling sound, and a bomb came down, striking near the head of the convoy of German vehicles. A petrol tank exploded, and Hugo felt the blast sucking air from his lungs. A second bomb landed just in front of them. The driver of his vehicle swore and abruptly put the car into reverse, throwing Hugo and the soldier guarding him off balance. It was only a fraction of a second, but Hugo decided to take his chance to escape. As he attempted to clamber out of the vehicle, there was a deafening roar of aircraft noise overhead. One of the fighters at the rear of the formation had broken off and was coming in low over the road. A machine gun spat out bullets. The driver flew upward as he was hit, then slumped forward. The vehicle careened wildly across the road.
A second bullet struck the man beside Hugo. The vehicle crashed into a burning lorry and rolled over. Hugo was thrown out. He was still conscious and trying to crawl away when the petrol tank exploded. And he knew no more.
Chapter 38 Joanna June 1973 As soon as I awoke the next morning, the first thing that came into my head was that I was leaving San Salvatore today. Renzo would drive me to the station, and I'd never see him again. And it occurred to me that I might have misunderstood Cosimo's desire to get rid of me in a hurry. Maybe it was not a fear that I knew something dangerous. Maybe it was that he sensed Renzo was becoming attracted to me. It was quite a coincidence that everyone Renzo fell in love with was somehow whisked away from him. Was that Cosimo's doing? I asked myself. Had he arranged for the local girl to attend a fashion design school she couldn't possibly afford? And bringing him back from England when he had a stroke was understandable. But keeping him here, needing his assistance every moment, was that really necessary? Cosimo was clearly one of those people who see themselves as the center of the universe and see others only when they can be useful. This thought led to another one. Renzo had mentioned that Cosimo had been in love, but the girl had rejected him. Might that girl have been Sophia? And to get his revenge, he tipped off the Germans about her and my father. That would definitely explain why Cosimo had smeared her reputation and why he wanted me to go so quickly. I was still trying to make sense of these thoughts when I went over to the farmhouse to take a bath and then joined Paola and Angelina for breakfast. The meal was a solemn one. Paola looked as if she might burst into tears at any moment.
"And I haven't taught you anything about mushrooms yet," she said. "The little wood mushrooms, so delicious. And ravioli. We haven't learned to make ravioli."
She reached across and took my hand.
"Promise me you will come back, cara Joanna. We will have such a good time, no?"
"I hope so," I said. "I hope it will be possible when this sad time with Gianni is over."
"Too bad you are not a lawyer here in Italy," she said. "You would know how to speak to this police inspector so that he listens and sees the truth."
"Unfortunately, we don't know the truth," I said.
"Whatever it is, it can have nothing to do with you," she said firmly.
"That's where you're wrong," I thought, but didn't say. We finished the meal. "I must go and pack," I said. I went back to my room and folded my clothes neatly in my suitcase. Soon I'd be back in grey and rainy London, buying a pre-cooked steak and kidney pie from Sainsbury's for my dinner, and wondering what my future would hold. I hadn't quite finished when I heard a tap on my door. "Come in," I called, and was startled when Renzo entered, not Paola.
"Are you ready?" he asked. "We have to hurry if we wish to see the monastery before we drive to Florence. My father insists I see a man about our grapes before this fellow leaves for his afternoon snooze."
"I just need to pack these last few items," I said. "Shall I leave them until we get back?"
"Or finish them now? Whatever you want,"
he said, and sat on the bed. It would have been disturbing enough at any time to have Renzo sitting on my bed watching me as I crammed undies into a suitcase. Now, knowing what I knew, fearing what I feared, it was almost unbearable. I picked up the spare shoes, the ones with the items from Gianni in the toes, and stuffed them with undies and stockings. Renzo said nothing as I put them into my suitcase. I finished, looked around the room, and closed the suitcase. "There," I said, "all done and ready to go."
"Bene,"
he said.
"Good. Now let us go on our adventure."
We cut across the vineyard between the rows of vines and picked up a track that went up the hill between olive groves. In the distance, we heard a shout and saw a cart going up the hillside on another track, the man exhorting his horse to move faster. Renzo stared at it, frowning.
"A cart," he said. "Something about a cart."
"What about it?"
A flash of memory returning. Something about a cart. A man came to our door and said he had brought the cart and